Yeah, see, that's
we probably won't get to the end of this, but
you my gadget wouldn't do anymore, see?
Okay.
That's the fact that won't, you know,
won't we require
expensive I'm gadget like this, and it's already not erasing properly.
Well, I'd like, maybe, we only have a few minutes, but could I possibly set up another time?
Yeah,
okay, so let's go on. Because there's so much here, and I know the parts, I'm you know, going as we're talking, leaning things that I want. So just continue, I'd just like you to just talk. I like what you very interested in your point of view about the church as community. And if you could go into this is what you've said all along, but I want to be sure that this is very clear. As I'm using your words, I can understand the sense of church within the community and I don't want to use Christian for, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with using Christian, but you know, how important I've, go ahead. I don't, you know what I was saying.
Well, we obviously have a number of allegiances as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
The way I see us as human beings is we, first of all, whether we like it or not, or know whether or not, we belong to the family of God as humans.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we are created, the fact that we exist.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of time, God, by sending us Jesus, has created the family of Jesus. Now, I simply, through the graciousness of my parents, really, received that gift of Jesus. I was baptized, in fact,
mm-hmm.
an hour after I was born. I was prematurely born.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really allowed to grow up, and I grew up in a community that, you know, where the faith meant much,
mm-hmm.
and in our home it was living faith and so forth. So we have that allegiance. So we have the allegiance, you know, to our fellow human beings,
mm-hmm.
as being, I see it, the family of God.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you want to call it, the human family, humankind, whatever. That's how I see it. But within that I see also that group of people who have committed themselves to the family of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
All right? But within that, we still have further allegiances. You know, we of the Catholic persuasion have a way of going at it, which is different, you know,
mm-hmm.
from the particular branch of the family of Jesus you've chosen.
Mm-hmm.
Although we're growing closer and closer together, because we have kept alive in our community that very strong sacramental life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, we're not just simply people of the book. We all are people of the book as Christians. Can't get away from that. But we have always had a very strong feeling that even, you know, that literally more fundamental than the book is the community.
Absolutely.
And that,
mm-hmm.
that the faith is lived in that mm-hmm. community, and that
mm-hmm.
that is where the book is being put into practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that therefore that community, you know, is important. Well, for me, of course, it was within the Catholic community that I approached this, but then even within that, we still have, I acquired a still further allegiance, or loyalty, if you want to put it that way, which was the Society of Jesus, the Jesuit order, of
mm-hmm.
which I was a member, or am a member. And so, and then on top of that, you still develop further allegiances, which then, although it may start with a narrow allegiance, branches out. My volunteering for and having been accepted for work in the state of Alaska, which is our Jesuit mission.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gives you an allegiance to, you know, to the Jesuits in Alaska, to the Catholics in Alaska, to the Christians in Alaska, to all the people of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And I therefore have always had a very strong feeling that we are a community. Granted that we have, you know, just like in my own community, I have a different allegiance to my parents, my brothers and sisters, my cousins, my second cousins once removed, plus, you know, short-tail acquaintances.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that sense, I look at you know, at our own wider society as having these various allegiances.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that none of those, or not any one of those, need prevent you from extending them wider. And so I've always seen my, you know, my presence as, well, at the university as well as now, as being basically nothing else but a kind of an instrument in the hands of the Lord to allow others to get to know Him mm-hmm. and love Him. Mm-hmm. And you can do that through anthropology, and you do through painting, and you can do it through painting and Christianity, and anthropology mm-hmm. and Christianity, and you can do that, you know, in all kinds of ways. And so I think what we have to realize is that, and what I always, you know, tend to keep in my mind was that, all right, I will do this, but it should always have a coloration, a horizon, a further dimension, and the dimension is that somehow or other, through whatever we do, hopefully we can create a little better world. You know, the kingdom of God, if you want to call it that.
Yes, yeah. I like it.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
Just like you.
Oh, thank you, my dear. Thank you. Yeah. In a sense of, and I don't know what that means because we all want to accomplish many things, but.
Well, have I accomplished? I would say I have, in a broad way, truly accomplished what I set out to do, in this sense that I left Belgium to go to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And there I did indeed get. And so in that sense, really from about age 17 or 17 and a half or so, when I was in high school and began college, I pretty well set my heart on Alaska. So I can pretty well say that I, you know, accomplished, at least in that sense, I reached the geographical area. What I, you know, where I'd hope to get. And within even getting here, I think I managed to do, well, I always saw my life sort of as being, you know, since I became a Jesuit, sort of as being in service to people, education, which is high on our priority list, kind of make it possible for people to, you know, reach some happiness in life and some mm-hmm. peace and so forth. And that's, and yeah, I think I can pretty well say, basically, I pretty well achieved what I set out to do. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I thought that would be your answer, but I'd like to hear how you would phrase
it.
And then there were a couple of other things that came to me while I was transcribing this, and this is sort of maybe a bit off track, but maybe not, in the sense that it, I was struck by a lot of your sensitivity and what you were saying. And you mentioned the realization of the stupidity and incongruousness of war. People of the same Christian denomination praying together to the same God to win a war they were fighting against each other, of course, which is always so ludicrous, isn't it? Are there any other examples of the pathos of life that stick in your memory, seem like not from the intellectual or academic standpoint, but more of how a priest especially may catch glimpses of a man's inhumanity and the humanity? And is it any easier for a priest or a Jesuit to reconcile life than the ordinary person?
Four or five questions.
Yeah, that's very common, isn't it? Yes.
Anyway, as I said last week, mm-hmm. that, and I thought about it again afterwards, you know, that really was one of the kind of a strong, you know, kind of a strong experience of the stupidity of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
That here we're in the same church praying, you know, and celebrating together, and yet as soon as we left each other's presence, we were enemies again. It is. Are there other areas where I've experienced the pathos of life? I think in a number of ways, as a priest, I would think in three ways we experience it quite often, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it is at the beginning of life, at the end of life, and in marriage.
Mm.
Because we are, you know, we are very often associated, of course, with baptisms, mm-hmm. initiations. And when I say initiations, I mainly mean older people who, you know, who find the Lord and are baptized and confirmed and, you know, mm-hmm. and enter into full communion through the Eucharist. And there, I think, you begin to sort of experience, you know, not so much the pathos of life with a P, but the battles of life, the depth of life with a B. Because there you see that, you know, that is that great hope, that great joy that is associated with either beginning physical life, mm-hmm. or beginning spiritual life. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we are quite often associated with that kind of joyful, you know, mm-hmm. joyful beginnings. In many ways, we're also associated with joyful endings. Mm-hmm. Because we as Christians, you know, we teach that that although this is a great gift from God, this life that we have, and the people we know, and the friendships we can form, and the, you know, the joy of living, nevertheless, we also at the same time experience the joy of living forever. And so death, you know, is not really the end of things, it's kind of a transition. And so very often we are associated with some very happy deaths, if you want to put it that way, or even some very happy celebrations of, you know, of the going of someone. And that has often struck me as, you know, as a very powerful experience. And although we in some way contribute to the possibility of others experiencing it, nevertheless, people may not realize it affects us very often as deeply as it does them. You know, sometimes the people that you know, but even when they're people that you don't know, very often it still moves you. And then, as I say, the place where I personally get very often deeply touched is in marriages, that is to say, at a celebration of the sacrament of matrimony, because there is this, you know, this kind of hopefulness, and there's this joy, and there's this willingness to, you know, to commit to an uncertain future, and there's this kind of happiness of celebrating this and the liturgy and all that. So very often that, to me, those are joyful moments, and they in a sense, you know, pathos need not mean the evil part of life, you know, the simply the depth of, you know, and the you know, the passionateness of life. Well, you see it in the beginning, you see it, as I say, in the middle, and you see it at the end. Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, as a priest, you come to experience very often the, you know, the joyfulness of life, the fact that people realize that life can be lived more fully when two or more people kind of commit themselves. In other words, the forming of whether it's you know, small communities, mm-hmm. the forming of larger communities. So in that sense, and although some of that is intellectually based, in the sense of, you know, our faith is not a stupid faith, it's based on mm-hmm. you know, on insight and understanding, both from Scripture as well as from our teaching. Nevertheless, it touches, you know, the human part yeah. very much. And since most of those, say, well-experienced occasions tend to touch more than just the mind. They touch the emotions, the heart. If there is, you know, a food celebration, they touch, you know, and in that sense they are kind of multi-form experiences, and, you know, and the richer they are, the better they are. So in that sense, yeah, I think we experience that, you know, quite often. And on a human emotional kind of interpersonal level, rather than only on the intellectual kind of mm-hmm. And I think people today, certainly within Catholicism, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, people have realized that it is okay to show your love, to show your affection, to show community, to, you know, to share happily and joyfully, that Christianity is not a private affair. You know, it's a group mm-hmm. of people sort of wandering together towards the Lord, and we have learned to wander kind of happily. mm-hmm. You know, not all that certain always of where we're going, but we're moving.
I'm interested in how the individual, you in this case, sees himself or herself in relation to society. Society being family, neighborhood, Alaska, and the world. And in a sense, you've already answered that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to say, these were notes I jotted down while I was thinking. In Alaska, we've had a real opportunity to be back to back with our history. Certainly, this is this time Have you got an overall perspective on that? You were part of shaping that history, you particularly, in as much as you had your foresight years ago to see the greater problem that might be happen with cross-cultural divisions. How do you feel in terms of being back with history, especially from your educational, I don't want to get into an intellectual thing, but when you've seen and known a lot of history, I mean, you're to be right in.
Well, I think it is very difficult to escape the feeling after a fairly short while in Alaska that you're in a sense making history.
That's right. That's exactly how.
Because I used to constantly say that part of our liberty in Alaska, I don't mean our civil liberty, but our freedom as a people, is that you can still do things here because nobody tried it before.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have 1600 restrictions or traditions that, you know, that fight against our doing anything. And so, yeah, I have felt very much that I'm part of, was part of, of the history of Alaska. I couldn't escape that because when I barely set foot in Alaska and I knew that I would have to start a high school,
mm-hmm.
and it was then literally the first and only high school on the whole Yukon River. So in a sense, that's
mm-hmm.
history. Not that that necessarily, was something that led to multiplication or to
mm-hmm.
imitation, but in a sense, in the history of Alaska, it was a step. You know, it was in a sense, and I'm glad that we, were first to do so. It was a recognition that. The native youngsters needed to be, given at least the opportunity. That it was not fair on our part to say, look, you got to stay where you are,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but that we will try to give you the best education we know we can give you, and then you choose what you want to do with your future. So in that sense, and the same thing with my work at the University of Alaska. The Department of Anthropology was very small, helped to build it up, restarted the master's program when I was there. I was there when the first person got, an MA in anthropology. So in a sense, that's kind of being the history, but also in the sense of working with a number of programs with the State Department of Education,
mm-hmm.
With the school programs. It was a time of great change in Alaska. I was on the board of directors of Thunder Times.
Oh yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
To see that get into into being, the boarding home program.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was constantly history.
Yes, it was.
Because constantly, mm-hmm. they were all attempts in order to struggle with this incredible, thing that was happening in Alaska.
And very few times in your life are you doing something that you know is setting a precedent. I mean, that this is.
Yeah.
Going to be the basis of what's going to follow. And that's
not necessarily the basis of what's going to follow, but at least you know that you're doing something
mm-hmm.
new that hadn't
mm-hmm.
been done before. And therefore, although that can give you great exhilaration, it also gives you a certain nervousness because it's untried.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore, you kind of live with the possibility that this may not, be the best thing in the world, but at least if you stay open to change and revision.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing when we started the rural school project at the University of Alaska. To bring these teachers new to the state of Alaska for 8 weeks to the university before they went out to the villages, a real step forward in terms of, cultural sensitivity and cross-cultural sensitivity. And yet I do know for a fact that was resented in certain quarters because the status quo is threatened. You can't mm-hmm. stay on your holy hill all year in isolation from the village and the culture if you have new people who come in with a totally different
mm-hmm.
mentality. Yeah, so I had very much a sense of being part of, and also of seeing the state grow and, and the oil development and even the legislative development and the population growth, granted that it's not, that fantastic, but nevertheless, it's all there. But also, I think what I also appreciated very much was the growth of, say, educational opportunities, educational outreach, the growth of, say, the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra, you know, things that for which I had a, you know, a real kind of affinity, you know, from my own background as a, you know, as a youngster in Belgium, and to see that slowly developing, same thing with the Fairbanks. One thing, these are things that I appreciated, Fairbanks Light Opera Theater.
Oh, of course, it was wonderful.
Fantastic things, the same thing with, you know, theater work at the university, the radio station. You know, and I remember that in 61 or 62, forget now, you know, I was interviewed on the radio station on College Road, and that little one-room hut was studio, transmitter, the whole darn thing. So, you know, a lot of things have happened in even 25 years in Fairbanks. And, you know, Alaska is basically one big little town.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. And so, you know, you get to know people all throughout the state, and even more so 20 years ago or 10 years ago than it is now, and throughout the city of Alaska, in contact with, you know, with various levels of city involvement, all the way from city governance down to, you know, all kinds of levels. And so in that sense, yeah, you couldn't help feeling, you know, that you're associated. Same thing, association teaching anthropology at Fort Wainwright. You know, the military involvement, the relationship between them. Yeah, you know, even the fantastic ecumenical spirit, churches in this city, and in Alaska generally.
Oh, I think it's remarkable compared to other areas. I'm not really well.
Well, we are much more ecumenically. I remember I'm not sure of the year now, but about 68. I taught anthropology to the Episcopal priests at Kotzebue. I mean, to all the Episcopal priests of Alaska, but the meeting happened to be at Kotzebue. Well, believe it or not, we there had the first ecumenical service in the history of the world in Kotzebue.
Wow, I'm not sure.
So, you see, I mean, so you get that feeling, you're associated with things that are really happening, and I found myself listed on the program as the homilist. Bishop Gordon put me on there, and I'll never forget that. This has come to my mind many times, so you speak of kind of the pathos of life many times, because people were kind of chuckling, I'm an anthropologist, they think of bones. So I took the famous passage from Ezekiel, you know, the bones in the scattered in the valley, how they will, you know, rise again, and how unless this community in Kotzebue, you know, with its splintered churches, unless they all come together, is going to remain bones. Well, that has often struck me afterwards, many, many times, that here it is that late in the history of the world, if you think of it, even in the history of Christianity, even in the history of Alaska, because, you know, there are at least four churches that I can think of, and more, you know, there's Catholic and there's Episcopal, and there are the Friends, you know, and there's some of the other groups. Anyway, so I can think of, well, for instance, I was associated with the study that was commissioned by the legislature, 67, 68, 68, maybe 69, you know, on the study on the future of Alaska. In other words, we all felt that we were at the threshold of very important days. Well, and I gave the, you know, the anthropological presentation in Anchorage. Well, you couldn't help but saying, look, we're, you know, we are such a young crowd, you know, the state of Alaska barely got going, and here we are, in a sense, facing the future somewhat intelligently. Well, it felt good to be associated with that. So yeah, I have definitely a feeling of being involved in the historical aspects.
You say you were impressed with the Jesuits as they how they handle life in a studious, scholarly manner. Is this as compared to a spontaneous, emotional, warm, cold sort of thing? In light of your feelings about the changes. Oh, I beg your pardon. That was the end of that question. I'm going on to another. I guess I see a tremendous amount of warmth in you. So I would imagine other things besides a scholarly studious manner would have impressed you. Perhaps the camaraderie, as you mentioned, or the feeling of extended family, or the strength or inability to be able to do something in the world through this order.
Well, see, when I was first associated with the Jesuits,
mm-hmm.
I was a fairly young kid. See, 41. Born in 26, so I was about 15 years old
mm-hmm.
when I first met them. First time I met a Jesuit, and there were about 75 in the house in this college, you know, this high school college mm-hmm. combination. And I found them, they're very friendly, they were interested, they encouraged you always in, you know, in educational endeavors. They were, I mean, to us, they were just intellectual giants,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little kid looking up to those characters. And there were some very famous characters
mm-hmm.
there, because I was in Brussels, and in that particular house, there are the famous group of Bollandists. I don't know if you heard of them.
Okay.
They are a group of Jesuits that have been at it now for several hundred years, and they are going through the calendar of saints in the church,
mm-hmm.
and they study each calendar day,
mm-hmm.
all the saints that are celebrated anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that have had some claim to fame, if you want to put it that way, and they ruthlessly knock out all those that don't, you know,
that's
don't
good.
Measure
yeah.
up. So these people have, you know, there's people there with experts in Syriac and all, you know, kind of all
mm-hmm.
kind of Eastern languages and so forth. So to be associated with those
my
characters
language.
And to
yeah.
just to say hello to them in the hall,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, I think I sensed, as I said last time, I think, kind of a real esprit de corps.
Mm-hmm.
But that was 1941, 42, 43, and so forth. That esprit de corps was not shown then as it is now.
Oh, okay. That was another
thing. See,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the church was different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church was a cooler church, if you want to
mm-hmm.
put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, it was a more silent church and that sort of thing. But I think when I then began to, you know, began to get into more studies, and when I finally decided to, you know, to become a Jesuit, by then I had also gotten to know a lot of young ones,
mm-hmm.
those in training, and of course they, being closer to your age, and you know, a little looser, was more. Yeah, I think it wasn't just, say.
Oh shoot! Excuse me. Did you try this with your machine? Did you?
But
the only thing that might be
thing.
Different is that thing. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. Isn't
it? Are we recording? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like that's exactly the same thing. So it ought
I
to do it.
Yeah.
But I haven't tried.
Okay.
Anyway, so what you were asking is.
When you saw the young ones, yes.
Yes, when I, you know, how did I react? Well, you know, obviously being closer in age and all that, and they being in training, And yet at the same time, they also showing, you know, that discipline, intellectual discipline, and they were good teachers and all that sort of thing. So it wasn't just, as I said, intellectual attraction and admiration, but it was there, no doubt about it. And also, once you get to know their history, that, you know, as an order, fantastic. But I think there was also this kind of a feeling that this would be a great gang, mm-hmm. you know, to be part of.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been borne out well, you know, throughout my, well, I ended in 47. So heading towards 47 plus 40 is 87.
37
years,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
In light of your feelings about the changes at the Second Vatican Council, I have your views on the current bishop's letter. I was, and if you don't want this recorded, it's all right.
You mean the one on capitalism?
Yes, and the fact of the awareness, making people aware of just how many, many people there are in the world that don't have enough to eat, for instance. I'm kind of upset about this at the moment because I've been going around in the stores and I just see this opulence. I think, my goodness, please be aware that there are people starving all over. How did that feel to you? Because I think, that, from my understanding, this is a relatively new thing for them to speak out this way, and I think it took tremendous courage.
Well, first of all, Vatican II dragged, if you want to put it that way, a reluctant church into the presence.
Yes.
And therefore, the build-up or the living out of Vatican II is to keep this church in the present and move it into the future. So the bishops, as a body today, are responding to this. They are saying, look, we are not a church assembly of the past that goes blithely through life, you know, unconcerned. We are a group of people who live in a society, who use the resources of this society, who share with our brothers and sisters, and who ought to share common concerns, and who also, therefore, ought to say something about our society. Well, they tried to say something, you know, a couple of years ago on, you know, the whole business of arms race and nuclear situation and so forth. Well, the bishops are sensible enough to realize that there are very few issues that are black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the moment you say they're gray, then, of course, that means that the well-meaning Christians, dedicated Christians, committed Christians, can nevertheless lean one way or the other and don't buy 100%. Granted that it's clear to point out where the clear evil, you know, things are we ought to avoid, the extremes, but in between there are options and choices. Well, what the bishops undoubtedly now are trying to do, and I have only read a few paragraphs, I haven't read the complete, because it's only a draft.
Mm-hmm.
And of course what they're doing by letting out the draft is, you know, it's like President Reagan is doing, just, you know, let up balloons and see which way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that the churches in the past, not just ours, you know, but Christianity as a body was too silent.
Mm-hmm.
And Christianity as a body tended to become too often associated with the powers that be, politically speaking, civilly speaking, you know, juridically speaking. But I think without really reflecting on it, we also bought the economic system in which we lived. And of course, we're all children of our time. That's the system we grew up in. We tend to think that that's the only system around and that it's the best.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today we know much better.
It,
you know, and although we can point to a lot of good points in capitalism, we can also point to some very, very great weakness in capitalism. You know, its exploitative character, the fact that it can only succeed if it has, you know, raw materials elsewhere, and of course, which means that some poor sucker someplace, you know, are working for very poor wages, and so forth and so forth. Well, I think the bishops will point out a number of those things, and then of course the bishops also have to point out that if we are truly a community of the world, you know, if we're truly people that ought to care for each other, well, then we're going to have to share, you know, our surplus somehow or other. But I'm sure that the bishops will also point out that bandaging is not the answer either.
I just thought it was a courageous step,
yeah.
and a long overdue one, and has some, from the whole Christian community.
The main thing that needed to be done, and that, of course, they have already succeeded in just by publishing the draft, mm-hmm. is to get Christian consciences stirred and thinking and talking about this. And I've read some criticisms already of the letter, you know, from some of the conservative stances. Well, you can say, you know, the bishops are people with the greatest job security and all that and so forth, so are priests and all that. But those are kind of, seems to me, kind of picayune responses to a very basic question. It seems to me the very basic question that's being asked is, are we in this world as stewards or as owners?
Mm-hmm.
And if we are stewards, then we have to give an accounting somewhere, not just as individuals, but as nations. And secondly, if we are all brothers and sisters, to push this one step further, then how can we just simply sit by and exploit the other group, number one, or number two, see that others are suffering? And then comes the sad situation, is that we as Christians, who now, you know, are somewhat roughly shaken out of our complacency and saw this whole situation, Ethiopia and so forth, and it's not just Ethiopia, it's the whole Eastern Africa there. Nevertheless, then we also begin to experience an awful frustration of wanting to do something, and for dumb political reasons, it gets, our efforts are frustrated, you know, because the dumb political situation, you know, the Marxist-leaning central government and the rebels and so forth and so forth. So it seems to me that that's part of being Christians. To live with that awful tension and frustration, and that we don't give up, but that we keep looking for ways to do something about it. Yeah.
You probably still have a great deal of your life left, I would hope so. As you, anything you want to think about in the sense of hoping to do, or as a sort of...
my future? Future forward? I think what I started, really, this is only my fourth year.
Adult education.
Adult education here in Fairbanks. It's, you know, it's just, the base is just laid. So I would hope that I can, you know, continue this for a number of years. So, that, you know, and, well, I'll be 58 in a couple of weeks. And so...
Yeah, he's 47.
I mean, giving in, you know, another 10 years beyond that, granted that I hope to live another 20 or more, as far as, you know, really active involvement and that sort of thing, 10, 12, 15 years, you know, is being pretty generous with yourself. So I would think that what I would hope that I can continue, you know, the teaching ministry as well as the ministry of you know, helping others to find the way to the Lord, you know, to find their move from the family of man to the family of Jesus. I firmly believe that people everywhere can find the Lord and find their way. But in sending us Jesus and in giving us Jesus, He's created the family of Jesus, and within that family, it ought to be, and it is indeed, you know, a little easier to find the Lord. So if I can kind of facilitate that transition from the family of humankind to the family of Jesus, for some people I'll be very happy. But at the same time, I hope that within the Christian community, you know, I can continue to, you know, to facilitate and to stimulate reflection and teaching and you know, scripture as well as theological, as well as historical. Yeah, I think that's sort of where I see it.
Thanks. All right. Push your time. I wanted to tell you.